Good day, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the iPro Nursing Home and Hospital Patient Safety Attentive Pressure Ulcer conference call. At this time, all participants are on the listen-only mode. Later, we will conduct a question-and-answer session, and instructions will be given at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the call, please press star then zero on your touch-tone telephone. As a reminder, this conference call is being recorded. I would like to introduce your host for today's call, Mr. Dan Yurchak. Sir, you may begin.
Hi, good morning, everybody, and welcome to today's presentation. We appreciate you joining us for this morning's conference call presentation, which is a part of a series of educational offerings addressing pressure ulcer prevention and treatment in both hospitals and nursing homes. Today's topic area will focus on effective communication. Copies of today's presentation were forwarded to you via email. These slides will be referenced during today's presentation. In addition, a program evaluation form was to you. Please fill out the evaluation form and send it back to iPro at the number on the bottom of the page. As a reminder, this conference call session is being taped and will be posted to the Jenny website and will be accessible for future review. We will send out the link to everyone when the recording becomes available. As mentioned, all of your lines are currently muted, but following the presentations, we will be opening the lines up for questions, comments, and further discussion. We are very pleased today to have Dr. Joyce Black and Dr. Jeffrey Levine as our guest speakers for today. In the interest of time, we've included their bios with the handouts. Please join me today in welcoming our speakers, beginning with Dr. Joyce Black.
Thank you very much. I appreciate being able to talk about talking. According to my husband, I can talk forever and basically say nothing. At least he doesn't listen. Maybe that's really what's happening. What we're going to talk about today is a combination of written interprofessional communication and then verbal communication. Dr. Levine's going to do that, the second half of that idea. My focus is really on the written form of communication and some of the dialogue verbal communication from one provider, particularly a nurse to a nurse's aide or other nurses, and then we'll talk about the rest of it. So my slide set is called Communicating Old Topic, Ongoing Issues. We were probably taught how to professionally communicate in our basic skills class, if you remember back that far, where we learned about the importance of not talking about ourselves and talking about the issues relevant and salient to the patient. Sometimes that gets lost in the process. We were also taught in our basic courses how to write down the information in the medical record in a clear and precise way to facilitate ongoing care for this patient. And as you and I have experienced, when we look at medical records, we don't always see it that way. We're not always pleased with what we're seeing in those medical records. When we think about ideal communication, of course, it's more than the misspelled school sign on the street. But the ideal written communication expresses ideas and facts clearly. That would be true in verbal communication also. But the written communication is legible and correctly spelled. And then that provides a record for later reference and, of course, evidence that care was provided. I have no idea if those of you that are listening have been involved in legal explorations of your care provided, but that is probably one of the most humbling experiences, is when you try to explain away why you didn't write down what you probably should have written down or why you didn't provide care that you know you should have provided and therefore didn't document it. So not that we stand at the footsteps of every courthouse in the nation, but I do think we have an obligation for many reasons to provide a record that carries forward the care that that patient got. So I put down what I thought were ideal pressure ulcer communication data. If we could find this out about every patient with a pressure ulcer, I think we'd be farther ahead. If we could find out the date that that ulcer started, when did it first occur? Because a lot of the problems we have with healing down the road, when we're looking at patients 3 and 4 and 6 months after the ulcer started, is the ulcer has now changed from an acute wound to a chronic wound. In fact, it did that weeks before. And until we can reestablish the healing trajectory, we often have difficulty getting the ulcer to heal. Some of that is based on how long have you had this wound, and of course the patients don't always remember. What events and diseases led to the development of this wound? Were you hospitalized when this wound started? Were you walking? I had a patient not too long ago who was diabetic with severe neuropathy of the feet and decided to go on vacation in Florida, which is perfectly fine. But he walked on the beach in July in Florida and burned the bottom of both of his feet. Well, he comes into the clinic with these necrotic wounds on the bottom of his feet and won't really disclose what he was doing because he doesn't remember because he doesn't have any pain. He only knows that when he got home and took his shoes off, which was a number of hours later, that his feet were bloody. And we had to kind of figure out backwards what had happened to him. Now, the best thing we could have done at that point is written that information down in the record so that as it goes forward, other people don't have to also wonder, how does somebody get necrosis of the bottom of both feet if it's not a burn? And we needed, and we did, record the story. We need to know what the past care was given, and there's really no place in our formal documents today to figure that out. It's very hard to figure out what's been tried, what didn't work, why didn't it work, and what's the trajectory that this ulcer is healing on. Is it healing? Is it not healing? When we look at the push tool, we only really get a total score and three variables that tell us the current status of the wound itself. But we don't know how well this patient's nutrition was managed. We don't know what chair cushion they were on. We don't know what sleep surface they were on. So there's lots of other variables in the story that would guide us as we try to move this patient's care forward. I think that if we were to find out what the outcomes were from the patient's perspective, the expected outcomes from the patient's perspective, there are lots of medical practices, nursing practices that really interact well with the patient and say, you know, what do you want us to do for you? And I'm not sure we always ask that of our patients. Is it expected that you think this ulcer is going to heal, or do you know from your past experience as a paraplegic that it takes a year to heal and you're simply not willing to wait a year for this ischial ulcer to go on to heal because you got to go to work? That kind of communication would be extremely helpful to us. Now, you can see on the next slide, and of course this is sort of Joyce Black's big complaint, what is often communicated when you compare to what I think would be ideal to know, this is what you see. Decubitus ulcer on buttocks. That's the words that you see on the transfer form. It just, in fact, it says skin condition, and then you check decubitus, and then in the little line you can write the location. So these are pictures of patients who were described as having a decubitus or a skin condition on their buttocks. And you can see there's a huge variety of types of wounds, all the way from serious deep tissue injury up in the right-hand column to a nice healing but fairly old stage 3 on the left, and then slough-covered wounds on the ulcer on the bottom of the slide being stage 3 or stage 4 for sure. So the word decubitus, of course, we need to get rid of from our vernacular, but the idea that this ulcer is on the buttocks as the only form of written communication provides you, the receiving agency, no place to start. You really don't know the history of that wound. So I would ask you, in looking at the next slide, what if you knew this whole story when you accepted this patient and transferred to your facility, or even if you were sending this patient on somewhere else? What if you supplied this? That the patient developed the ulcer after surgery a week ago. It was found 2 days after surgery, and therefore they suspect it was a deep tissue injury that started during the operation. The initial care included putting this patient on a low air loss bed and limiting her position in a supine position so that we could get the pressure off. They have a Foley in her. They think her oral nutrition is okay. The current size of the ulcer, it's unstageable because it's fully eschar covered, and they started to debride it today, but now she's being dismissed to your facility. Much more of the story than simply a decubitus ulcer on the buttocks. You know that this wound is relatively new, recently necrotic, in a patient whose physical condition may have greatly changed from her condition at the time that the ulcer started. At the time the ulcer started, she was anesthetized, immobile, inactive, unconscious, all of that. Now that she may be up more, the ability of this ulcer to heal is not going to be impaired by the usual problems with immobility and inactivity. It appears that her nutrition is okay. So you would forecast this ulcer as having a higher likelihood of healing, even though it's necrotic at this point, because of her improved physical condition from the time that the wound started. If this patient were an older patient who developed this ulcer during a prolonged hospitalization for acute respiratory failure, where she was on a ventilator and not fed for a week and a half, you have a different picture in your head of the likely ability of this wound to heal. And therefore, the instructions you have and the care that you set out to provide would be completely different. So some ideas to improve interagency and intra-facility communication. One thing is, I think we need to have a standard data set that is got consistent information in it. And until we have it, the one we have now, the standard transfer form we have now, is woefully inadequate because, as I said before, all it says right now is skin condition and you've got five options and then a line to express where that is. It doesn't give you enough information. In the interim, if you could ask about the attributes I've listed, it would help you to know the stage and size and other attributes. What's the peri wound look like? What does the bed of the wound look like? As we said before, what's the date of the onset? What led to this ulcer? And not in a way to cast blame, not to say, oh, it started on your watch, but to understand that the etiology of the ulcer is different, and therefore the trajectory of healing could be very different. And obviously we have more than pressure ulcers to think about. What did the facility do initially and what became of that? Is the reason this patient's being transferred is that the wound is deteriorating rapidly and the patient is septic, or is this wound improving and they just need to go on for further wound care and continued physical therapy? So what's the plan for the future? Is the patient expecting this wound to heal? Does the patient realize that if they have pressure ulcers on both heels, that the ability to walk for rehabilitation is going to be impaired and we're going to have to fit them with different shoes in order to keep them ambulatory? And then, of course, kind of reflecting back on the idea of lawsuits, you know, it's many times the family that brings the lawsuit or the charge against us because they claim, and I know that you're going to hear more about this in the second half hour of this presentation, the family claims that they never knew anything about the wound or that they were notified of a small but healable ulcer, presumably a stage 2, and then the next thing they know about it, the patient's in the emergency room with pus draining out of the ulcer and septic and nearly dead. That level of infrequent communication, laying out the wound is doing this and we're not making any headway, would be very critical to have at the time of transfer and then from that point on. Probably can't communicate too often on that. From an interprofessional communication, that's between me and you, some of the problems that we see across the nation are that pressure ulcers are not discovered until they're a stage 2 or beyond. They're a necrotic eschar cap on the heel, and no one has found them. And it certainly raises a lot of eyebrows as to why you would never discover this in a hospital setting where these patients should be assessed at least twice daily by the nursing staff and at least once daily by the medical staff. And the ulcers aren't found until they're necrotic. I don't believe that we can get necrotic tissue in a heartbeat. I don't think it occurs between 8 and 9 o'clock in the morning. What is interesting to hear when those are found is a lot of conjecture about, well, I think this ulcer happened en route between the hospital and the nursing home or between the home and the hospital or whatever this transportation thing is. And, of course, I love to ask, how far was this? Did the patient drive from Ohio to California, or was this rehab facility simply around the corner on the sixth floor of the same hospital? Staging errors, we're going to look at some of these in just a second. Wounds that are pressure ulcers are staged. Wounds that are not pressure ulcers are staged. I love to tell the story of a nurse of mine several years ago who came to me and said, "Dr. Black, come quickly. We have a stage 6. And I need you to see it." So we walked down the hall quickly, of course, and I was asking her where this wound was, and she said, "It's right on the chest, and I can see the heart." So I said, "You can see the heart? Was the patient prone for like a month and a half? How would you get a pressure ulcer on your sternum Oh, of course it wasn't. It was a sternal dehiscence. She was staging, using the pressure ulcer staging system, to describe a sternal dehiscence. It's got nothing to do with pressure, except for suture pressure and those kinds of things. We use the staging system because we know it the best, and it implies that we're describing pressure ulcers. And then we don't always do a great job describing the deterioration of the ulcers. So we're going to look at some of these issues. When ulcers are not discovered until stage 2 or beyond, if that's a situation you've seen in your facility, a couple of things to think about as far as a plan of correction. One would be to teach the nurse's aides to report any skin issues that are not normal. And if the nurse's aide doesn't know what normal is, I would encourage them to think about themselves. If they don't have that same dark spot on the back of their heel or purple spot on their buttocks, come and find a licensed nurse, LPN or RN, to look at it. That should result in over-reporting. That should result in nurses being notified a lot about skin conditions, and that should not be punished. That should be appreciated, that these nurses' aides have stepped up to the plate and said, oh, you know what, I want you to look at this. I'm not sure what this is. We need to teach the nurses' aides to examine high-risk areas. That means in order to see the heel, they have to take the clothes off. They have to take the TED stocking off. They have to take the shoes and socks off. In order to see the sacrum, they have to take the sheets down off the bed if the patient's bedridden and pull the folds of the buttocks apart. Pericare can't be done when the patient's supine. So those should be expectations and part of our teaching. We need to expect a full skin assessment by licensed nurses. We need to not be willing to accept the fact that this ulcer was found in a necrotic state when it shouldn't have been. It should have been visible earlier, and the nurses should have seen it. The problem we have with the skin assessment by the licensed nurses is, again, we don't have a documentation system that's standard to invite the level of detail that we want. In our hospital system documentation record that we just changed a couple months ago, we used to have all these details about lungs and heart sounds. I mean, you could write forever on lung and heart sounds. And on skin, we had one entry, intact or not intact. That was it. So we didn't know what we were looking at. We didn't know the etiology. And I think we need to do a better job in getting the record one that allows nurses to make those levels of detail. The next slide you're looking at, you should be seeing six photographs. Of course, those are the six stages of pressure ulcers, four staged by number, one deep tissue injury at the 8 o'clock position, and one unstageable at the 1 o'clock position. It's been shown to be a good way to teach staging is to use photographs, that people respond to photographs and can learn to be accurate. Of course, what's missing in photographs is the odor of the wound, the condition of the patient, the appearance of the patient when you walk in the room, because this photograph is taken after we've moved the patient off the ulcer. So there's some pieces of the physical exam that are not communicated by photograph, but still it helps to at least initially teach people what the difference in staging is. Monitoring the accuracy is done in part by validating it in real patients. So you would teach it in a classroom on a web-based program with the pictures, and then you'd go around and actually find patients, much like you do with the Braden, and just validate that, yes, that's what we think we see. And you look at, is this really not a pressure ulcer at all, but a diabetic foot wound or a venous stasis ulcer? And then once it's, of course, a stage 3 or 4, it stays a healing stage 3 or 4. And then you're back to sort of the questions about how good your documentation is. Correctly labeling other wounds, of course, with this present on admission ruling that started in October, this has become an increasing topic of discussion. Stage 2 pressure ulcers in and of themselves, the absolute stage 2 pressure ulcer, I think is pretty rare. I think what happens is a lot of other conditions are classified as stage 2s, including the list I have there for you. Incontinence-associated dermatitis is commonly classified as a stage 2. And if classified as a stage 2, it implies that pressure was the etiology, and therefore you could be considered liable for that when you really had nothing to do with that. If this patient's been chronically incontinent and the best you can do is keep the skin clean and moist after each incontinent episode, you really have a lot less arguing to do about it being a pressure ulcer. Skin tears and intertriginous dermatitis between skin folds, I've even seen dehisced incisions classified as stage twos, and of course those have nothing to do with pressure. Important to start clarifying in training of nurses what areas are prone to pressure, and the pressure ulcers occur in tissue subjected to pressure, be it pressure from an endotracheal tube, be it pressure from a tracheostomy collar, from a boot. It doesn't matter what the device is. It need not be the bed or the chair. It could be any device. We need to impress upon people that wet skin and dry skin are more prone to ulcerate. We need to impress upon them that if we identify this ulcer as a pressure ulcer, using the typical things to treat pressure ulcers, that is nutrition and pressure relief and local wound care, the ulcer should heal. If it's a different wound, it will not heal along the pressure ulcer trajectory. We aren't going to get a venous stasis ulcer to heal by feeding the patient and doing pressure relief. In fact, we're going to need to add sustained and gradiated pressure up the leg in order to get it to heal. So we've got to get the correct diagnosis first in order to set a plan of care in place. The labeling all open wounds as pressure ulcers is really harmful, not only to your numbers and your quality assurance numbers, but it makes it difficult to kind of explain yourself when you have the inspector groups come in. Now, correcting the time factor, what I mean by this is how can we see these ulcers quickly and see them appropriately? The weekly assessment of skin in low and moderate risk residents is okay, as long as the risk assessment's accurate. I don't see a need to undress people who are ambulating around your unit, but you need to look at the high-risk patients, and we need to be diligent about looking, even if it's not the scheduled day for a weekly skin assessment, we need to be looking to find them early, and we need to teach the nurses' aides and nurses how to do that. And then each time a dressing is changed, we need to be noting if the wound is healing. If it's not healing, it's inappropriate to stand around with your hands on your hips and say, well, we'll get to it, it'll heal eventually, we're not due to do a formal recording of this wound till next Monday, even though we can see it's deteriorating on Friday. That's not acceptable, and we should not be teaching that. The standard is to record weekly, but the assessment actually should go on with each dressing change. And then the last slide, recording the analysis. It's expected that pressure ulcers should heal. That means their size decreases, their necrotic tissue is less, the slough disappears, the granulation starts to occur, and is pink and robust. When those conditions are not present, when this ulcer is not healing, well, then don't continue with the present treatments, because you could say, well, how are they working for you? They're not working. So you need to stop and look at and document that you've reviewed their offloading, that you've reviewed their diet, that you reviewed their treatments, that you've put a plan in place to change the care. You've talked to the family, you've talked to the resident about what the plan is, you've talked to the physician or the WCN. It's a team to get all of that done, and the team needs to be notified because, of course, they all can contribute to the right care. The last slide I have, just to transfer this over to Dr. Levine, is anybody can communicate. You can see the elephant is painting. That doesn't mean that we can understand what the elephant is trying to tell us. It's just that the elephant's making notes on this artist board. The monkey in the middle is thinking. We think really hard sometimes, but we don't always think clearly, and we don't always communicate clearly. So we may be thinking well, but we're not writing it down. And then at times, of course, like the school sign, we're writing it down, but because we misspelled so many words, it doesn't lay out a very good picture of our ability to communicate. Thanks very much. I'm going to stay on the line, and I'll be here for questions at the end. Turning it over to you, Dr. Levine.
Thank you very much, Joyce. Before I start, I just have a technical issue. I could not download my PowerPoint, but I could download my my black and white handout. I was wondering if somebody else can confirm that or whether it's just my computer.
Well, let me see if I can get it open. No, I can get it.
Okay, good. So I'm just going to go ahead, and I think I have over 20 slides, and I'll just be prompting the audience to go to the next slide. I'm going to be talking about communication today. Some of the concepts that I'll be discussing are building upon Dr. Black's concepts, and I just want to start by saying that communication is more than an abstract concept. And JCO has identified communication as a root cause in over 70% of sentinel events, and these sentinel events include pressure sores. The objectives of our discussion today are going to be dealing with negativity in the workplace, communication and risk management as it applies to pressure sores, disclosing adverse outcomes. I'm going to talk about this in general and then focusing in on pressure sores. I'm going to talk about communicating with families and the family meeting and how important the family meeting is in addressing the concerns of the illness of their loved one. Going to talk about the medical record and how the medical record is not an effective form of communication and how we need to supplement the medical record with face-to-face discussions. And finally, at the end of this talk, I'm going to introduce the SBAR model, which has been recommended as a general model for which we can pattern our communications between professionals. Going to start with dealing with negativity in the workplace. Negativity is contagious, and if you see this little slide here, it's just as contagious as MRSA, it's just as contagious as VRE or Clostridium difficile. Exposure to it can take a toll on anyone's positive attitude. Next slide. The consequences of negativity in the workplace are poor morale, decreased productivity, loss of motivation, increased turnover, and most importantly, impaired patient safety. The symptoms of negativity are many. They could be manifest in infighting among staff, rumors, excessive complaining, and disruptive behavior. There's been a lot of discussion recently about disruptive behavior. There's been a focus particularly on physicians because the American Medical Association has come out with policies. JCO has come out with policies particularly concerning physician behavior. However, these policies really apply to everyone. And disruptive behaviors could be looked at as follows. Disruptive behaviors include profane language, demeaning behavior or name-calling, ethnic jokes, expressing anger, open criticism of others, intimidation of other staff, and overt flaunting of facility policies. Next slide. Here are some suggestions as to how to approach disruptive behavior. Be positive. Open the lines of communication. When there's an issue, focus on the issue, not on personalities. Here's a concept I heard recently of rewarding employees for their contribution and calling them skin snoopers. This was very successful in a South Carolina hospital chain that I recently visited. They actually rewarded staff members for finding skin lesions, which overcomes the fear that many people have in reporting skin lesions to their superiors. They called them skin snoopers and rewarded them for every new skin break that they found. Maintain diversity by bringing in different types of people and emphasize different talents that people bring, particularly important with interdisciplinary approach to pressure sores. It's also important to let team members know where they fit. And administrators and leaders must lead by example and foster camaraderie, it's very important to establish a process to review, verify, and address disruptive behaviors, particularly when behaviors don't go away. And you might need to take a look at your policy and procedure manual and come up with a policy and procedure manual specifically designed to address disruptive behaviors. I'm going to move on to the topic of communication and how important communication is to risk management and build on some of the topics that were discussed previously by Dr. Black. But first, I'm going to define risk management because many people are confused about the concept. Risk management is the process of assessing risk, then developing strategies to manage that risk. In practical terms, this means minimizing chances of litigation and minimizing one's exposure when a lawsuit occurs. Next slide. Pressure ulcers represent half of all nursing home litigation, and hospitals are rapidly catching up, especially with the labeling of pressure sores as a no-pay event. Pressure sores, as we know, are closely linked to the perception and measurement of quality. Let's move on to discuss some of the dynamics precipitating litigation. To understand these dynamics, we need to be aware of the communications that families and patients are giving to us. Anger. The doctor never told me about the ulcer. This was discussed by Dr. Black. When patients or families have incur pressure sores and don't know about it until late in the game or until a debridement is needed. False hopes. They told me with this salve, the ulcer will get better. Denial. How many times have we seen this in our hospitals or nursing homes where a family comes in and says, Mom was never sick a day in her life before she got to your place, and then we find out in the chart that this patient has been on tube feedings for the last year. Prolongation of family dysfunction. My brothers and sisters could never agree about the feeding tube. And then once the patient passes, this family dysfunction continues to live on and gets transferred into the courts. Next slide. More dynamics precipitating litigation. Resistance to a reasonable plan. When a family member says, I want everything done to keep that individual alive when the situation is medically futile. Lack of information. I never got answers to my questions. This causes anger. Desire for vengeance. I will take the industry down. Finally comes financial need where people can't pay medical bills, and then there's the desire to protect others from similar harm. So what do we do when we hear these sorts of things coming from our patients and from the patients' families? We want to recognize and proactively act on litigation risks. We want to maintain trust by encouraging cooperative, non-defensive discussions with family members. And when you speak to them, speak in a tactful, calm, and empathetic fashion rather than being defensive and challenging. Encourage meetings with family and staff and document the discussions, who was there and what was discussed. I remember speaking to a young physician who said, why should I document the family discussion in the chart when it has nothing to do with the care of that individual? Well, this is a misguided notion. Discussions with the family are always part of care of that individual. Place the documentation in the medical record rather than in a drawer or some other place. Always involve administrative personnel or your risk management department when you feel there's a litigation risk. And if there's multiple family members with confused lines of communication, designate a contact person and explain the lines of communication and why it's so important that one person needs to be that contact person. Next slide. Be aware of communication. Poor communication between staff and the resident's family will affect the perception of care, causing anger, mistrust, and misunderstanding. Communication with the family is the simplest, most cost-effective risk management tool, and I feel that nurses and social workers are often untapped in their potential for family communication and risk management. Often, the social worker is the one that is able to detect anger, false hopes, denial, and desire for vengeance and financial need amongst family members, so they could make other team members aware of potential litigation risks. And finally, understand, next slide, that communication is not just verbal. Recently, a family member came to me extremely upset about a pressure sore that had happened in their loved one. And they described a situation where the sore occurred, and they called the enterostomal therapist to come and do a wound care consult. And the family member described the enterostomal therapist as coming to the desk, opening up the chart, and sitting looking at the chart, shaking her head and hanging her head low. And this behavior was described to me, and this behavior was the precipitant of extreme anguish among the family member that something had gone wrong. So remember that communication is not just verbal. The next section we're going to talk about is communicating with families. Communicating with families, you want to address family concerns promptly and empathetically. You want to take the time to talk as well as listen, and keeping alert for risk-prone families, as we had discussed. It's very, very important to discuss the realistic prognosis, and if the patient is medically futile, suggest palliative care or hospice. How many times do we overlook this very, very important component of healthcare? And document these discussions in detail. The family meeting. I'm going to just discuss the family meeting for a moment. The family meeting is a therapeutic communication where we can discuss what to expect and address the concerns of the family. Discussing feelings with a healthcare professional can reduce psychological stress, and therefore this is a therapeutic communication. It's an opportunity to enhance quality of care, sharing information, clarifying goals, and assuring that the resident will not suffer. A family who is struggling with end-of-life decisions needs those decisions to be supported, and this is the opportunity to do so. And family meetings should not be saved for crisis situations. Rather, look at family meetings as a preventive approach where the issues are anticipated. I'm going to go on to discussing adverse outcomes such as pressure sores. The disclosure of adverse outcomes is required by JCO-accredited facilities. It's suggested that disclosure of adverse outcomes such as pressure sores occurs early, and avoid comments suggesting blame. During the meeting, it's suggested to sit in a quiet place, sitting down at eye level with the family member, empathizing with the family's emotional state. Don't do it alone. Involve the director of nursing, the medical director, some other authority figure in the hospital, and possibly your risk manager. And document the discussion and who was there. The approach makes the difference. In the next slide, I have two different examples of how a physician communicated with a family member in disclosing adverse outcomes. The first example is as follows, where a doctor is discussing a pressure sore with a family member. Your mom had some major risk factors, and despite our efforts, this also developed. We're very sorry this happened, but we will try to get the best care for it. Compare that to example two, where a physician says, if those nurses had done their job at turning and feeding your mom, this would not have occurred. We may need a surgeon to cut out that dead tissue. This communication alone is something that can either make the family feel better or make the family feel angry and wanting to sue the facility. The next section talks about the medical record and how the medical record is not an effective form of communication. And in the next slide, I'm going to use the example of a nutritionist who's coming to the bedside and writing time after time to increase the patient's tube feedings. In this case, the nutritionist simply writes his or her assessment in the medical record and says, need to increase tube feeds. But the message never got across to the busy doctor who didn't take the time to read the nutritionist note, and unfortunately, the patient never got increased tube feedings, and the pressure sore subsequently got worse in a state of malnutrition. So keep in mind that the medical record is not the only place to communicate. In fact, it's a very inefficient place to communicate, and communication should always be face-to-face with the medical record as a supplement. Next slide. The medical record is not a place to express anger, as is depicted in this note, where a physician wrote, "We were never informed of the admission," with exclamation points and underlinings. The medical record is not a place to point fingers, and it's not a place to express anger, and it's not a place to place blame. This should be done away from the medical record, as these documents can often be used in court in a lawsuit. Next slide. And the next slide, we're going to go over a model that's been developed for communication. And this is a very good model which we can pattern our communications to one another in healthcare such that the communication is succinct and gets across the information that we want to get across. And this is called the SBAR model. SBAR stands for Situation, Background, Assessment, and Recommendation. Situation is the problem, and the background, as it's communicated, should be brief and to the point. The assessment is both subjective and objective, and the recommendation is what you recommend in that particular situation. And we're going to take the example of nutrition in a patient with a pressure sore, where the situation is, I think this resident needs more calories. The background in the next slide is this resident has a pressure ulcer stage 3, which has gotten worse in the last week. A is for assessment. We're going to move on to assessment. He is eating only 25% and taking less than 1,000 calories, which is a very bad situation if you have a patient developing a pressure sore. And finally, the recommendation, maybe we should have a family meeting to clarify goals and consider alternate means of nutrition. And this is a way to encapsulate and make sure that the entire communication gets across to whoever needs to hear it. I'm going to go to the communication summary and wrap up some of the major points I've made today, that communication is the backbone of care, not only for pressure ulcers, but for all aspects of care. Communication is an under-recognized risk management tool, and this is where your nurses and your social workers could step forward and help in risk management. That communication is not just verbal, that when we discuss patients and when we're around our patients in clinical situations, we need to be aware of our nonverbal communication. And finally, the medical record is not the best place to communicate. And that wraps up my talk today.
Thank you very much, Dr. Levine, and thank you, Dr. Black, for your presentations as well. At this point, if the operator could open up the lines for questions.
If you have a question at this time, please press the 1 key on your touch-tone telephone. If your question has been answered and you wish to remove yourself from the queue, please press the pound key. One moment, please. Our first question comes from Victoria Mosado. Your line is open.
I have a question. Treatment of stage 3 ulcer, how much time do we have to give a patient, for example, if the treatment doesn't work? Like, do we have to give them, like, at least a week or so to, to observe? 2 weeks? 2 weeks, okay.
You want to address that, Joyce?
Sure. I think the basic question is, what does the wound look like now? And what are the treatments you're using? If the wound is slough covered and you're using what's left of our enzymatic debriders, it's going to take a couple weeks to pull all that off. If this is a patient who you are using an amorphous hydrogel, so you're just filling the cavity with a gel and covering it with a dressing, it should not be showing signs of slough. It should be improving. So you got to kind of look at where you are and where you're trying to get to, and what road you're on to get there. I've had patients who or staff who've put enzymatic debriders on thick eschar, and then they're wondering why they're not getting anywhere. Well, they're never going to get anywhere. That's the wrong treatment for that wound. So we'd be waiting a year and a half for that patient. So without knowing the specific details, I can't answer the specific question, but what you need to look at is, what's the wound look like now? Where do you want to get to? And if you're trying to get it to granulate and close, it should go, depending on its depth, it should go reasonably quickly as long as you are nourishing the patient and offloading the patient and keeping the wound clean. So, I think there's too many variables to look at to say, oh, within 2 weeks you should have this. Wounds tend, on the flip side, to deteriorate more rapidly than they heal. So you should be seeing signs of deterioration and acting on them, and that's why I think you should do daily assessments of wounds when you're changing dressings, because you're looking anyway. That's where you can make your most rapid changes in the course of the wound, is by catching those signs of deterioration early.
Thank you.
Our next question comes from Mevi Shakespeare. Your line is open. Mm.
Hi, my name's Dr. Louis Modenecki, and here in Brooklyn, Cobble Hill. I've got really a question for Dr. Levine. as well as just a comment for Dr. Black. The question I have for Dr. Levine is, I'm here in Brooklyn, New York. What role does cultural competence play in communication? To me, this is the forte in areas like Brooklyn and the Bronx, where you have very, very, very culturally diverse populations with very different expectations. What is being done, for example, by the American Board of Internal Medicine, the Fellowship for Geriatrics, into teaching doctors who are going to be working in this area cultural competence, if any?
Doctor, this is such an important question, and unfortunately, it's not being adequately addressed by many of the current professional bodies. And I think that especially with the trend in American healthcare to have our primary care physicians be mostly foreign medical grads, it's extremely important because the people who are on the front lines aren't from the area. And it's, of course, extremely important when you're communicating to families, when you're communicating to patients, to know what their values are, to know what their advanced directives are. So perhaps that's a great place to start, just to see what your advanced directives are and what the expectations of the family are in this situation.
As I'm sure you're aware, ethnogeriatrics is the fastest growing field in the United States in terms of care of the elderly. And I really feel this is not just underappreciated, but it's also not dealt with properly. The other comment I wanted to make was really for your colleague, Dr. Black. She mentioned anecdotally about the man who went to Florida and walked on the beaches. My only comment to that is there's a wonderful, wonderful supermarket, Chinese, here in New York, which produces 50% flip-flops. The use of flip-flops would really, you know, prevent pressure ulcers in people who are going to walk around barefoot in the heat. And it's not just really practical, but it's also cost-effective and could prevent a potentially disastrous litigation. And just a one-line documentation in the chart, patient counseled on diabetic foot.
Oh, we do teach our diabetics to keep their shoes on, but, of course, we're not with them 24-7, and he didn't ask us to go to Florida with him. Had he asked us, he wouldn't have burned his feet.
Thank you, Dr. Black.
Doctor, thank you very much for your comments.
Our next question comes from Stephen Kanner. Your line is open.
Okay, I have a question in regards to... Oh, I'm Pauline Koh from Dr. Susan Smith McKinney. I have a question in regards to correctly labeling the wounds. We always have some disagreement when it comes to a patient, for example, who was primarily diagnosed with a fungal rash. We know that we don't stage that, but once it deteriorates and it goes to a higher stage, it's just like there is this confusion as to addressing it as a fungal infection rather than a pressure ulcer. For example, if specialists in a pressure area, the patient is immobile, and you know that the ulceration is deteriorating because of the pressure. So this is a very, very confusing state. We're in when we make our rounds, we have a lot of disagreements on this. Could you please give us a better understanding on how to correctly label this wound?
I'm sure that Joyce is going to have a lot of things to say. I'd like to start with my comment. Wound care by nature is it generates a lot of discussion and a lot of disagreement among the team members. I would suggest in a situation where we can't agree on what the ulcer is, I believe that one person on the team needs to be empowered to make the final decision, and that decision should be adhered to by the rest of the staff. And if we don't do this, there's going to be conflicting documentation where one person is going to say one thing and one person is going to say another thing, and the chart's going to end up looking like a documentation mess. And this sort of situation is what lawyers love to see, what plaintiff attorneys love to see when presenting a case for negligence, because they can use that conflicting documentation to make their case, however inaccurate that case might be, but they could effectively make their case that these people didn't know what they were doing, even when they did. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Joyce.
Thanks. That's an excellent point. My first thought would be to make sure you have a fungal rash. If you're looking at skin fold problems, we cultured skin folds about a year ago as a research topic, and we didn't find much fungus. We found MRSA and VRE and Enterococcus and E. coli, and you name it, we found it. It was a garden of gram-negative and gram-positive stuff growing in skin folds. So if you're treating it with an antifungal, you're only treating. We found some candida in those skin folds, but not much. So, A, I would culture it, see what you really had first. That may be part of the reason it's not improving. And then once skin is damaged, once the outer layer of skin is damaged, the skin is more subject to pressure. So you could have fungally injured skin now increasingly injured by pressure. I would not disagree with that. I also wonder, though, about exposure to urine and feces to make sure that that's part of the management. But step one would be to make sure you know what you're treating and that you're appropriately treating it. If it's a candidiasis kind of thing, improving the bacterial flora of the patient, so giving them a probiotic, something like that, if they've had lots of antibiotics, would help you to just correct the problem. And then air would fix, and wicking away the fluid would fix the dry skin fold, if that's the problem. But I agree with Jeff. Somebody needs to make the diagnosis and make it once, but I think you need to make sure you know what you're diagnosing and get all the data.
Hey, I just clarify. I'm an MDS coordinator, and I think the main reason for such disagreement is because you are on two different pages. It's because of the MDS coding, wherein it's very clear in the manual saying that even if the primary cause of this is a fungal infection and it is it ascertains that pressure is due to immobility of the patient, such deterioration of the ulcer is due to a pressure, therefore it should be staged as such, and pressure ulcer. I think this is where the confusion is. Just for example, a doctor is on a different page, an MDS coordinator like myself is on a different page. That is where we have the difficulty.
I just want to interject something that I don't know whether you're aware, but the MDS 3.0, at least CMS is telling us that the MDS 3.0 is coming around next October.
Yes.
And the MDS 3.0 has a largely expanded skin section, section M, and this is going to clear up, hopefully clear up some of these things. Actually, might very well end up giving us more confusion, but one way or another, the MDS 3.0 will be with us very soon, and we're going to be learning a whole new set of rules.
Yeah, I agree. It's true. It is better. I think people will hopefully appreciate the detail. Of course, with detail comes the arduousness of dealing with it. But, you know, I guess an analogy that I'm thinking of this fungal rash that deteriorates under pressure. I mean, a patient could have angina from congestive heart failure, but also could have angina from an MI, and I still think you'd need to know the cause because you've got to treat the cause, and it may have started with fungus, but it may now be something completely different. You know? So the care plan has to address the etiology of either the original problem, if it's still there, or the current problem. So some kind of fluid wicking project would get the skin fold dry or the back of the body dry. Maybe a low air loss overlay would help dry it out. Okay, enough. I think we probably need to take the next one. Thanks. You bet.
Our next question comes from William Gardner. Your line is open.
Hi, good morning. This question is primarily for Dr. Black. I want to ask you about process, because one of the things that you had mentioned is the communication of information from one level to the next, and sometimes we don't have enough information. And I was wondering if you could talk about the process itself of getting that information. What I'm finding is that many facilities may transfer a patient, but they transfer written information only, and they don't have a conversation. And I think it's a lack of conversation. I mean, I'm used to working in a hospital and receiving reports, so you get a chance to ask those questions. But do you have a process in place that communicates verbally from one level of care to the other?
We do from floor to floor within our hospital.
Okay.
We have a lot of people who evaluate the patient prior to transfer to long-term care or rehab, and we are able to communicate with them. Now, the problem that we have is sometimes they They come on Tuesday, and the patient's transferred on Friday. And we don't always get a call from the facility receiving them. That's, you know, as much as I'd like to say we should call the facility should probably call the hospital and say, you know, what's the story on this patient? My fear is that there are long-term care facilities, rehab facilities, that had they known the whole story of this patient would have never accepted them. You know, they're going to tip the scale on what that facility can provide because of their current case mix. I think that belongs to the long-term care facility, rehab facility, to call the hospital and find out more about that patient prior to transfer. Hospitals don't have that luxury. I mean, we get who we get. We can't control our inpatient volume. People come to the ER, we can't turn away. But long-term care, and especially because it's driven with such heavy prospective payment, I think it would help all of them if they made a call to find out the whole story of the patient, because clearly that transfer form is so inadequate. And I can't imagine that you guys are many times startled on what you get versus what you thought you were getting.
Thank you.
You bet.
I'm not showing any questions at this time.
Perfect.
Okay. If there are no further questions, I actually can see that we're just about out of time. I hope that everyone enjoyed today's presentation and found it to be very informative.
Excuse me, please. We've got one more question just come in.
Okay.
Victoria Mostos, your line is open.
Okay. Thank you.
Hi. Good morning. This is Brian McKenzie from Jamaica Hospital.
Hi.
This question is primarily for Dr. Black, and I'm just thinking about the standard data or the standard communication that she mentioned, and with the coming of electronic documentation, is there anything that is going in that direction as far as documenting and communicating about pressure ulcers?
The only thing that's coming in that direction is coming, again, out of the federal government. It's a document called CARES, C-A-R-E-S, and it is a humongous electronic medical record that will go with patients from setting to setting to setting so that you could actually see the whole history of the patient with some detail. I am not aware of another group that is championing a better transfer documentation form, because somebody needs to champion that thing, and I'd be 100% behind it. But I'm not aware of one, and I'm not aware of one coming out of the formation of electronic medical records. So, yeah.
I would like to add something that in having had the opportunity to look at several electronic medical records, I've seen a large variety in quality of programming as to how we're documenting pressure ulcer prevention and pressure ulcer assessment and pressure ulcer treatment. In other words, many electronic medical records have entry fields where we are supposed to put in ulcer description. And some electronic medical records that I've seen simply don't address the types of things that we need to have in there. So there's just no place to put it when we want to put it in there.
Right, right. I agree. Yeah, sometimes it says skin intact, not intact.
Exactly.
Yeah, yeah.
Thank you.
Our next question comes from Rosalind Stonehill. Your line is open.
We have a question about the SBAR communication. What we find is that a lot of the nurses, they have a problem with the recommendation, because they're afraid to recommend intervention to doctors. Do you have any suggestions?
I do. Don't be afraid. Don't be afraid. There's many nurses know more about treatment of wounds than doctors. So don't be afraid to speak up, especially if you've got a formulary. I'm working at St. Vincent's Hospital right now where we have a formulary. And if a doctor recommends something that's not on the formulary, the nurse just has to question that and say, look, you know, we don't have Dakin solution. Dakin solution hasn't been used for years, and we can't use that. So I would say just washing away fear.
Okay. Okay.
No, that's exactly the right answer. I mean, if nurses are taught not to make medical diagnoses, and we obviously can't write prescriptions short of an NP level, but that's not what it's recommending. It's not diagnosing. And so just even if the recommendation is, I don't know what's wrong with this patient, you need to see him, that's a recommendation.
Okay.
If the product that you want to use for wound care is not up to the standard of care, just say our institution, the recommended treatment in our institution is X, and is it okay if we order that? Rather than saying, you screwed up, you ordered Dakin's, the recommended treatment of this wound in our institution is with this product, is that okay? And I think you're right. MDs, not all MDs know as much about wound care as they get saddled with, their primary care physicians, and wound care isn't one of their usual problems.
I'm not showing any questions at this time.
Okay, before we close today,
excuse
I just
me,
want
please,
to...
Excuse me, sir. I have another question just come in.
Okay.
Victoria Musso.
MERT from Jamaica Hospital. For infected wound with Pseudomonas, what product are they using? Are they using Dakin or acetic acid?
I'd like to start with that one. If you've got an infected wound and if that wound is showing Pseudomonas, the first thing I would say is get your infectious disease consultant to give some recommendations about the antibiotics. That's number one. Secondly, Dakin solution, and I'd like to hear what Joyce has to say about this, but Dakin solution is an outdated solution that was developed in World War I in the trenches. And in my view, it has no place in modern wound care. It basically kills any healthy tissue, kills any leukocytes, kills any of the cytokines or the small molecules that are involved with healing wounds.
I don't disagree on Dakin's. I have to admit, a couple years ago I was involved in an incident with a surgeon that ordered Dakin's, but that stopped pretty quickly. Dakin's may seem to be appropriate in a wound that's simply draining pus and is filled with necrotic tissue. For those wounds, you need to get a surgeon in there and get that wound cleaned up. There is, and I may be stretching, but I don't believe that the treatment of wound infection can be handled solely by the topical product. It has to be managed systemically, and because what you're putting topically on a wound cannot move through dead tissue into living tissue, which is where the infection is. It has to come through the bloodstream. So the use of silver for the treatment of Pseudomonas might help you reduce the count, the volume, but it isn't going to treat the underlying infection in the tissue. You've got to deal with it systemically. So you've got to get infectious disease in there to help you with an appropriate antibiotic. The topical should not be Dakin, should not be acetic acid. We once in a while use silvadine just to quickly unroof the amount of dead material in the wound. We have used silver. I haven't used honey. I haven't tried honey. But we really rely a lot on our surgical staff then just to get rid of that stuff and give us a fairly clean wound bed.
Is the tri-silver here in the hospital?
They do.
I'm not showing any more questions at this time.
Okay.
All right, let me try this again. our next conference call right now is scheduled for March 11th at 9 a.m., and it's going to focus on both the nursing homes and hospitals sharing their experiences and collaboration with each other. As we get closer to the date, we're going to send everybody all of the necessary information for the call, and I hope you all will be able to join us for that call. I also would like to remind everyone again, if you can just please fill out the evaluation form and send it back to us at iPro at the number that's listed on the bottom of the page. Once again, I just would like to thank Dr. Black and Dr. Levine for taking the time out of their day to give us these presentations and fielding the questions as well. Thank you all for listening, and I hope you could all join us again in March. Thank you.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for participating in today's conference. This concludes the program. You all may disconnect and have a wonderful day.